The following podcast is brought to you by Iconic Nation Media. Welcome to Season 5 of Level Up Podcast. I'm your host, Kimberly Levy. I'm here to guide you on a journey of personal growth and fulfillment. Join me as we delve into the challenges of both business and personal life, aiming to discover our true selves and connect more deeply with the world around us. On this podcast, we'll explore the topics that inspire and empower us to become the best version of ourselves. From book reviews to interviews with iconic individuals, we'll have insightful conversations that resonate with your journey. And a big thank you to our sponsors, the Boys and Girls Club of America, Greater Naho Valley, and Levy's Deli for supporting the show and helping us bring these valuable discussions to you. Please share, rate, and review the podcast. And thank you so much for listening. You can also leave your comments at Kimberly Levy on social media. Thank you for your feedback and thank you for listening.
If you're entering into some kind of an agreement or a transaction with another person, you have to look at it from the big picture perspective, right? How important is this deal to me, number one? What do I stand to lose if this deal goes sour? And what kind of financial resources do I have that are available to me, right? So if you're trying something out mostly for fun and it's not mission critical to you, that you'd like the other side to perform as they are promising, but it's also okay if, you know, they don't, the world's not going to crumble, then maybe it's not worthwhile for you to spend money on a lawyer.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Level Up Podcast. Today, we speak with Natella Shannon, business attorney and co-founder of Grant Shannon Law Firm based in Sherman Oaks, California. I wanted to speak with her because many of us are not aware of when and how to use the legal system in our business dealings, and it can feel like a black box. I want to leave this with you so you have another tool in your toolkit should you ever need it. We discuss how to find the best attorney to your specific situation and when it's appropriate to invest in an attorney. In light of AI legal contracts becoming more and more prevalent, we discuss the importance of using a solid contract from a licensed attorney to protect you versus when a detailed contract may not be necessary. I even ask her a multitude of basic questions, such as if an oral agreement is binding and when we need to document conversations. We cover how she was able to grow her firm so rapidly, implementing workflow tools and positioning her employees to be in the right role for them so as to set them up for success. We consider leadership styles that empower her team and optimize skill sets each person possess. In addition to be a powerhouse attorney, Natella is a wife and mother of two. The most striking thing to me about Natella is how she is both a brilliant and highly knowledgeable powerhouse, but she also has this warmth and nurturing sense about her that can be so comforting in stressful moments. She truly possesses unique qualities that inspire me as both a businesswoman and a mother. I know you will get so much out of this. If you think you may need legal support for your business, look no further. Her firm handles anything from basic contracts to real estate transactions, mergers and acquisitions, and so much more. You can find her on Instagram at Natella Shannon ESQ or visit her website at grantshannon.com. I'll link both of those in the show notes for your reference. She will help you map out your best next steps for your legal business needs. So don't be afraid to reach out to her if you need some guidance. Please share this episode with friends, family, and colleagues that may benefit from it and may be in need of legal assistance. And if you do reach out to her, please use my discount code LOVEY. That's LOVI. With that, Natella Shannon, welcome to the Level Up Podcast. Natella Shannon, welcome to Level Up Podcast. I'm so happy to have you on. How are you doing?
Thank you so much for having me. I'm doing well.
Okay, so I am dying to share you with the world because you are, and I'm not just saying this because you're my actual attorney, but you are one of the most badass women I know.
Oh, thank you.
And I just know you from like the boardroom, right?
Right.
I can spot a badass woman from a mile away.
Ditto.
From the second I spoke with you, I was like, this woman, she's a bulldog. She knows what she's talking about. She's the best. So can you give us a little bit of background about the type of law you practice and how you got into the type of law that you practice before I ask you more tactical questions?
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you so much. I feel myself blushing. let's see. So interestingly enough, I have only ever really been practicing business law. I had a tiny little thing with insurance defense right out of law school for like 6 months, but that doesn't even count. I actually started out my career in business litigation. I was a litigator for about 5 years, and it was great. I loved it. I loved litigation strategy. I still love litigation strategy. But then I started having kids, and it became just challenging with the deadlines and the very early morning court appearances. And so I decided to pivot into still stay within the business arena, but to pivot more towards transactional law. That's, I think, a little bit more sympathetic to females and to moms. And so I've been practicing corporate transactional law for the last, and that's really anything from really basic incorporations and things like that, although I don't do them myself anymore. I have a team that does it, too. Really high-end mergers and acquisitions, real estate transactions, partnership negotiations, and things of that sort.
That's amazing. And so do you have your own practice now?
I do. I am a partner in a firm, the managing partner. We have about 15 lawyers. And so I mostly do, well, I do a lot of operations and business development, which I love, love, love. But in terms of the lawyering itself, I do mostly the strategy development, and I oversee the work of my associates. I don't really draft anymore, although sometimes when we're shorthanded and I have to, I do it and I get into the zone, and then I'm like, huh, kind of miss this a little bit. Because, you know, I don't think that people perceive lawyers as creatives. I think that they think that we're all just really like super analytical and factual and, you know, but there's a lot of creativity that goes into at least what I do. You know, you take two people, sometimes six people or 10 people that all want to come together to do something, and they all have different objectives and desires and personalities, and you figure out how to put that together or to unwind something like that. It takes a lot of creativity.
It's very interesting you said that, because it seems to me, this is my perception of it, just based on my interactions with you and then also having dealt with, you know, a multitude of contracts over my career, you know, on the business side, of course. And it seems like the first, I'll just say third or half or whatever part of your career as a lawyer has to be like learning the rules to the road and right. Really, you know, not just through law school, but also through practice and right. By doing the, I hate to say grunt work, but right. Doing,
no, you gotta do it.
You know, walking the walk. It seems like the level that you're at, just from my interactions with you, is like you have that baseline, you know, foundational understanding of the rules of the road and all the laws and the ins and outs of it. And you know it cold. And then that's where you get to, as you take on cases or consider taking on cases, you're able to apply a higher level of thinking where it becomes more of a strategic application and strategic thinking around, okay, based on everything I know about the law and based on everything you're saying, here's the approach I would take. And it seems very creative on just the overall strategy piece, in addition to the way that flows through contracts. So I think that it makes sense what you're saying to me just from like an outsider, but it also seems like you have to be more seasoned in your career to get to that level.
Well, yes. And I think that you get different types of lawyers and you get different types of people. Not to say that one is better than the other, but and in hiring other lawyers and in working with a lot of lawyers, I kind of see that, you know, you sometimes get people that they love. They love the minutiae of what they're drafting. They love to get into all the weeds. They just, you know, they don't necessarily maybe love people as much. Not that they don't like people, but they prefer to interact with paper rather than people. And sometimes these people are brilliant and their work product is amazing, but they don't have the ability to really kind of see the big picture. Right? And then you get the big picture people like me. I consider myself a big picture person, where I sort of over the years have developed this bird's eye view ability to look at a transaction or to look even at a client who comes to me and kind of really just understand how all the pieces of the puzzle fit together. So I think, yes, experience 100%, but I think it also takes a certain type of personality.
I can totally see that. I feel like my husband is more of like the former of what you described. Yeah. Like he's very detail oriented in the weeds. He's less like, he can get into the big picture, right. But I definitely see that that is you exactly. And I love it.
Well, people like us, myself, probably wouldn't be able to do what we do without having people like your husband, right? And that's why I'm supported by such amazing lawyers, because I can have this big idea of, you know, how should this deal look like? And then I can give it to one of my lawyers and say, okay, this is the big picture. Mm-hmm. Now you go and you figure out, you know, what needs to go into it so that it, so that the end result is what I'm telling you it should be.
Mm-hmm. I love it. It's such a CEO vibe. I'm obsessed, obsessed, iconic. Okay. So I want to ask you, I feel like one of the big reasons why I think it's so important to have this conversation with you is because I feel like especially, and this podcast is not just for women, but I do feel like as a female leader in business, I don't feel like women are comfortable and educated on engaging attorneys. I don't know that we're encouraged or that it's ever talked about. And I feel like it takes quite a long time to get to a place where you realize, oh, I need an attorney. And I just think the more information, the better. So I want to ask you some questions about when and how people should engage attorneys and what contracts should look like. So my first question is, when should somebody engage an attorney versus, for example, and it's almost embarrassing to say to you, because you're like such an elite attorney, honestly. Oh my God. But like, you'd be surprised, just yesterday somebody said, oh, why don't you just have like an AI drafted host contract?
Oh gosh, for my... those are the bane of my existence.
And it's going to become a bigger and bigger trend. Right. So when is it appropriate to use like a templated kind of contract, and when is it absolutely necessary? Like, how do we know when to engage an attorney?
Well, as most lawyers like to say, it depends. You know, in my mind, and this is, I do this with everything, it's a cost-benefit analysis, right? You know, if you're entering into some kind of an agreement or a transaction with another person, you have to look at it from the big picture perspective, right? How important is this deal to me, number one? What do I stand to lose if this deal goes sour? And what kind of financial resources do I have that are available to me? Right. So if you're trying something out mostly for fun and it's not mission critical to you, that you'd like the other side to perform as they are promising, but it's also okay if you know, they don't, the world's not going to crumble, then maybe it's not worthwhile for you to spend money on a lawyer. If you guys are clear on what you want to do, I have litigated contracts on a napkin. I kid you not. That's that true story. That has happened. Right. Then maybe that's okay. The one that was on a napkin should not have been on a napkin. But I'm just saying, you know, sometimes people just do things based on an oral understanding. And sometimes that's okay. I'm probably one of the very few lawyers that will tell you that that's okay. Most lawyers are going to be like, no, you have to have a contract for everything. But again, I'm a big believer in looking at things holistically and also being very practical. So if you don't have very much money to hire a good lawyer, and this thing that you're doing is not, you know, doesn't determine the course of the rest of your life, then yeah, then it's okay. Then you know what? Get a template, just write it out in your own words, get the other person to confirm via email. And then if you see that this thing that you're doing is actually on the road somewhere and it's, you know, turning into something a little bit bigger, then it becomes worthwhile to, you know, formalize it more. If on the other hand, you're doing a deal that's very important, that's important to you, there's a lot on the line, you're going to spend a lot of time, you're going to spend a lot of effort, maybe you're unsure of the person on the other end, maybe you don't know them very well, maybe you are seeing red flags, then under those circumstances, certainly hire a lawyer. But you know what's interesting? I actually have a lot of, have had and have over the years, a lot of very successful business people that got so entrenched in the success of the business that they forgot that they needed a lawyer. Oh my God. And then they come to me and I kind of have to like unwind, not really unwind, but like understand and restructure and redo and fix everything that they've done over these years. I'll give you an example. I had a client, a very successful investor in real estate development. And so he partnered up with a developer and they were doing business for probably close to 5 years, building together, investing a bunch of money, all completely, they were really good friends. and really trusted each other. But it was a fucking mess. It was all completely disorganized. Some of the properties were on the name of one of the partners. Some of the properties were in the name of the other partner. They didn't have any operating. There was just nothing. And so they came to me and they said, okay, we want to get our shit together. We want to get organized. We started the process. And then a couple months later, the developer had a heart attack and died.
Oh my gosh.
And then for over a year, I basically had to divorce my client, the development investor, from the widow of the developer. She had no idea what was going on in his business. She wanted everything. And it was a huge mess. It was super emotional. It held up projects. So, you know, this is like a live example. Sometimes us lawyers, we paint such scary scenarios to our clients when we say to them, like, hey, you should do this because blah. And then sometimes the other person will say to me, yeah, but like, what are the chances? And like, it happens.
It happens. Yeah. Stuff happens that's not expected.
Yeah.
And so to that end, I hear a lot of people, it feels like everyone, and maybe this is a little bit on the CPA front too, and I recognize situations are different, but by and large, I feel like I'm always hearing about people forming LLCs. You have to have an LLC versus an S corp or a C corp or whatever else there's out there. Like, when does someone have to form an LLC versus another type of corporation?
I think that the reason why you hear mostly of LLCs is because they are most suitable for smaller businesses. Mm-hmm. There's not a tremendous difference between an LLC and an S corp. A C corp is a sort of its own beast that's designed for larger companies, or sometimes the government requires you to be a C corp if you're in a particular industry. These are usually reserved for those companies that are going to go after maybe like really big institutional investors. Maybe they plan on going public. That's what it's reserved for. And then on the LLC versus the S corp front, there are some differences in terms of how, under certain circumstances, each one is taxed. Again, this is not my forte at all, but from the legal perspective, they're treated fairly similarly. LLC has a lot more flexibility. There's less corporate compliance than an S corp. And the really, I think, beautiful thing about the LLC is because there's more flexibility in terms of the relationship that members versus shareholders in an S corp can have. For example, in an LLC, you can have 50% in equity and I can have 50% in equity. But we can agree that because you're putting in more time into the business, you're going to get 70% of the profits and I will only get 30%. So the LLC allows you to have that flexibility, where with an S corp, everything has to be divvied up based on how much equity you have. It's kind of one of the examples.
Oh, that's very helpful. Yeah. Okay, that's great. Okay, so you mentioned something about oral agreements, and this has actually come up a couple times for our family and various deals and things. How binding or not binding is an oral agreement?
Well, so the question isn't really whether it's binding or not. Technically, it's binding. An agreement is an agreement, right? The problem becomes when you have a disagreement over your oral agreement and the two parties forget what the agreement was. Mm-hmm. That's where the problem becomes. So if someone comes to me and they say to me, you know, I had an oral agreement with Joe Smith and Joe Smith breached the oral agreement. So I'll have them explain to me what the agreement was, where the breach took place. And then the next thing I'm going to ask them is, I'm going to say, what evidence do you have to support the fact that this was in fact the agreement and the fact that it was breached? Because without this evidence, you know, sometimes it's email, sometimes it's text messages that tend to show the intent of the parties. Because without that, all that's going to happen, yes, yeah, sure, we could sue. And we could say until we're blue in the face, this is what the agreement was. At the end of the day, it's going to become a he said, she said. Mm-hmm. And those are usually fought based on how good you present to the judge or the jury. And really not on what actually happened, because it all then will come down to how credible you appear.
Okay.
Without the evidence. So yes, I guess the short answer is they're binding, but the longer answer is they're difficult to enforce.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So is a best practice as a takeaway, like a practical takeaway for people, let's just pretend that you work for a private business owner and he or she says, hey, Kimberly, I'm going to give you a bonus at the end of the year, this amount, you know, as your holiday bonus in December. Is the best next step is for me to then acknowledge that in writing and send an email saying, hey, per our conversation, I just wanted to, you know, confirm this was what we discussed and kind of outline the details. Is that helpful?
100%. I mean, we're getting a little bit into the employment territory with the question that you posed, and that is not my area of expertise. So just a disclaimer.
Okay.
But yes, absolutely. Anytime someone promises you something, reduce it to a writing. Write them an email saying, this is memorializing our conversation. This is to confirm X, Y, and Z. If your understanding differs, please let me know within X number of days.
Okay.
And this way, even though you don't have them signing on the dotted line, by them not responding to you and rebutting what you're saying, that's acquiescence,
mm-hmm.
which will potentially be helpful to you in the future if something goes south.
Okay, perfect. So then like more from like a business dealings lens, this is more of like an etiquette question, I think.
Yeah.
So if, say I'm selling a business.
Yes.
And I have three buyers. Yes. And one of them seems to be more attractive for ABC reasons. And they give me, we have an oral agreement about something.
Okay.
And we say, we're going to keep the terms fairly simple. It'll just be ABC terms. Is it like bad etiquette or is it unexpected for them to then propose or send you a contract that is like very, very, very detailed? Like, is that a red flag? Is it a turnoff?
I think it depends on the transaction.
Okay.
I mean, I would always recommend, and I tell my clients, you know, before you get down to writing an actual agreement, put together a short form LOI and let's make sure that everyone is on board with these terms. Because the thing is, what people don't realize, the bigger terms oftentimes have a lot of like subterms or things that you can't. I'll tell you right now, I have a client that, they have three properties, big properties. They have like CVS's and Walgreens on these properties. And they have a loan with a bank for, I don't know, a big chunk of money. And so this loan agreement basically says that if one of the tenants, i.e. Walgreens or CVS, gets downgraded on S&P, then the landlord gets to sweep all the rent rolls from that property and keep it in a specific cash account. Okay. But it's all in one agreement, and the loan is one loan for three properties that's cross collateralized by all three properties, right? Mm-hmm. So now the question becomes, do you sweep the rent roll for just that one property that got downgraded, or do you sweep it for all of them? And we're fighting about it because the agreement's not clear.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like these little things that you sometimes we don't even think. I mean, we try to think of everything, but sometimes we don't even think of these little things when we put out sort of like these big picture terms. So A, I always recommend an LOI so mm-hmm. that parties can see that they're on the same page. In terms of sort of the length or how robust the agreement is, it depends on the transaction. I mean, listen, you're going to get some lawyers, like I'm reviewing an operating agreement from Melvany and Myers right now. They drafted it for like a such a simple deal. Like it's an LLC, two parties are going into it. It's at its infancy. It's like the simplest thing you can ever think of. And it's a 200 page document that like anticipates if they go public and there's tag along rights and drag along rights and all these different classes of membership, like they do not need an agreement like that, you know? So is it offensive? I suppose it could be, but it's also kind of like useless and pointless, and it just wastes everybody's, you know, time and money. I try to be very efficient, and I really try to nail down, like, what are we doing here? Mm-hmm. Does this warrant something robust? And sometimes it does,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes it doesn't. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of how you have to gauge it.
Yeah, and I think you're really good at that. I think you're really good
at that. I
try. Yeah. Okay, so as a best practice as somebody that's selling a business, this was a real case scenario, and I candidly, my jaw was to the floor and I'd love your input.
Okay, let's hear it.
So somebody I know, and I'm obviously not gonna, you know, name names or say who or anything, but somebody I know came to me and essentially said they built this business for several years. They had products involved and they sold their company, you know, successfully. They sold their company and they're retained as an employee, but you know, they no longer are personally promoting their products for that company.
Okay.
Because they've been acquired.
Okay.
And it was disclosed to me that they feel that they were sold a bill of goods. And I'm like, well, what do you mean by that? And they said, well, I didn't get anything up front. I got equity. And I said, okay, like equity with the assumption of an IPO or some kind of sale, like whether it's private or public, doesn't really matter. And they're like, yeah. I'm like, okay, well, that's fine. And then, so what's like the term? Like, are they in like pre-deal mode? Is it like a year, a 2 year term that the company, the new parent company is expected to sell? And they're like, no, we, you know, nothing's in motion. Like there's no deadline. And this person did not receive any cash up front.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So essentially what happened was this person sold their business, is an employee of the parent company.
Right.
And feels like they got nothing. And they have equity, which is, again, it's a privately held company that's not selling.
Okay.
Is that...
I have an opinion.
That sounds like...
Well, okay. So a couple of things. So thing number one is, and I don't know this, but if they have equity in this new privately held company, are they getting profit distributions pursuant to that equity that maybe make it worthwhile for them? So that's one option of why someone would want to do it like that, right? If there aren't any profit distributions, or if they're small, then, you know, I agree with you. The only way that they would do it is with some kind of an exit in mind in the future. So under those circumstances, the way that I would structure a deal like that is I would say, okay, great. I'm giving you this with, you know, an exit in mind in X number of years. And because I no longer have a say, or the client no longer has a say in what happens with the company, you do an and or, not an and or. You basically do an or. You say, okay, in 3 years, if you don't do an IPO, or if you don't do like a for cash sale where I can, you know, capitalize on this equity, then you have to pay me out for what I sold you. And then you figure out what the valuation is going to look like. Is it valuation from today? Is it valuation from later? So it's just, you know, whoever was advising that person didn't advise them properly, and now they're screwed, and it sucks.
Yeah. Yeah, I've never heard of a deal. I have a lot of friends that have sold companies and done very, very well. And to my understanding, most of them have certainly gotten cash up front, with some of them getting, you know, additional equity options, like stock options.
Yeah, I mean, it could work in a million different ways.
Yeah, it can.
Right? Some people really, really believe sometimes in this other company and it's cash poor for whatever reason, or it's not liquid. And so that's why they would do it. And that's kind of the beauty of contracts, right? Because it'll tell you what'll happen in the future if this thing that you're doing this for doesn't take place. And how do you still get compensated?
Yeah, there's none of those terms. I was beyond shocked.
Well, it sounds like this person needs a new lawyer.
I was going to say, this person needed you.
I mean, now it's too late.
Right?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, so how can someone vet that an attorney is the right fit for their particular needs? Any tips on hiring an attorney? Do's or don'ts? Red flags, must-haves, any of that stuff?
So you know what's funny? I get a lot of people leaving their lawyers and coming to me. And the number one reason why people leave their lawyer, do you want to guess what it is? It's like so basic that you can't even imagine that like it's a thing.
They can't get in touch with their
attorney? Yes.
Yeah.
What the fuck? Like, really? I don't know if I'm just neurotic, but I don't think I've ever responded to an email in like more than 24 hours. Okay, so well, number one, make sure that your attorney is going to be responsive and available to you. Gosh, you know, I think a lot of it, and I'm going to get a little woo-woo right now, but I think there has to be like an energetic alignment of sorts, if that makes sense.
It does.
You have to make sure, because look, your lawyer, and I think that lawyers have a bad rep, a lot of them, especially, you know, thinking from, I don't know, 10, 20, 30 years ago, where you mostly are thinking about like men in stuffy suits, and then they, you know, they act as if they're so much smarter than you and they know so much better than you. And then, you know, it's intimidating. I think your lawyer needs to be your confidant, like your partner in whatever you're doing. They need to have your best interest at heart. And so if you look at your lawyer as your partner, then you have to make sure that you're personalities just kind of jive, right? You know, I work with all kinds of people and I have been able to learn how to adjust depending on who I'm working with, but some people don't know how, right? So sometimes I'll get a client that's more timid and they're really unsure and they really need someone to take the lead for them. And if I sense that that's the case, I'm never going to impose it, but I will offer it to them. I will say to them, look, you know, if you want, I can take the lead. You know, I can do this for you. And sometimes, and they love it, right? Sometimes I get a client that is super intelligent. They know, like you, they know exactly what they want. They know exactly what they're doing. They just don't have the legal wherewithal because they didn't go to law school of how to put it together, right? So in that case, I'll take a step back and, you know, I will look to you for guidance in terms of what does this look like? What does the business look like? I'll give you my opinion, but I won't overshadow your strategy. I will just fill in the gaps where stuff's missing for you. Does that make sense?
It makes so much sense. And I love that you're talking about this like softer, like emotional intelligence type side, because I actually think it's one of the most important things and I've never heard it talked about ever.
Oh yeah.
And I will say this, when you're in a legal situation, you feel vulnerable.
Of course.
And it's almost like, forgive me for this analogy, but it is an honest, like how I really think of it. Like for the women out there, especially, if you have ever had a baby or even just an OB, you're very vulnerable.
Yeah.
You're vulnerable, yeah, right? Like that person is like all up in your business.
Everything's out in the open.
It's all there. And you have to feel so comfortable right with that person. What I get from you and why I think we clicked so much is that I, in such a vulnerable, like anxious state that is very stressful, like you're not at your best. Like I'm not calling you like shiny and happy and let's go for drinks. Like I'm stressed out. I don't know what to do. I'm confused. I'm used to being in control right, and I'm used to like knowing what's going on. And right, you're very vulnerable. That's the best way I can say it. I felt that way.
Right.
So clicking with your attorney and the personality, I think, is really the thing that it either puts you at ease or it agitates you more.
Right.
And I definitely see in your personality, you are adaptable. You can kind of tailor your approach to your client as you were describing, and you do that beautifully.
Well, look, my goal is to give them comfort, and sometimes it comes in different ways.
I need a hug.
Anytime. Yeah, I do that too. Free hugs. Hugs are free of charge. Also, you know, sometimes people just feel really guilty and ashamed of whatever situation, predicament they find themselves in. And, you know, and they're really worried that, you know, I get people apologizing, like, I know I'm stupid, I shouldn't have done that, you know, about whatever it is that they did. And I say to them, look, it's done. It doesn't matter. People make mistakes. Let's fix it. Like, that's why you're here. So, you know, if I were looking for an attorney, I would probably look for someone like myself. I just think, I guess to summarize, someone that's responsive, someone that you just feel comfortable around them. Because look, in order to get effective legal counsel, you have to be 100% honest. If there's stuff you're going to leave out because you're embarrassed or whatever, it's not going to serve you, because then we're not going to know how to help you best. So you got to feel comfortable with them. And you have to feel like they give you a sense of comfort in terms of, you know, whatever they're doing for you, whatever they're doing with you. And then, yes, they have to be competent, obviously. So you want to make sure that they have, you know, the relevant expertise that you're looking for. But, you know, that almost comes secondary, because there are so many lawyers out there with so much expertise and zero people skills. And it makes me really sad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's the thing that really does differentiate you. And I'm not just saying this like to like continue to, you know,
keep it coming,
praise you, but it is true. I think in any profession, because I've had hundreds and thousands of people I've worked with in my career as a management consultant, and I've seen all the different personalities. And if somebody is technically very competent
right,
and has the soft skills, it's incredibly rare, which is weird.
Right.
And I think that's something with you that I immediately recognize, that you know your stuff cold and you have all those tools in your toolkit, but you also have the soft skills. So, okay, I want to ask you something. You said something that definitely I can relate to, and you spoke about men in suits being intimidating, like in a boardroom or in a legal setting and whatever. And this is, you know, this is a world that you live in that has a lot of rules. There's a lot of things to know. And I just want to know how you handle yourself or disarm a situation or take control of a situation when you see there are men or women. It can also be women trying to intimidate you in a business setting, and how you kind of navigate those situations.
Well, it's an interesting question. Well, first I'll tell you that, and I think about, I have two girls, two daughters, and I think a lot and often about how I can best empower them as women. And so I reflect on my journey of getting to where I am. And people will often also ask me, well, what's it like getting to where you are, you know, being a woman? And, you know, I have to tell you that I very rarely think about it or feel it. I've always just gone based on my gut and on my intellect and on my confidence. And I've never allowed myself to feel victimized mm-hmm. by the fact that there are perhaps less opportunity for women than for men. I just like kept my eye on the prize, and I just kept going, and I just didn't care. And yeah, there were times where I would walk into a conference room full of men, and I would get all kinds of funny looks, and then I'd sit down and start talking, and then they'd be like,
Game over.
Okay, you know. And I kind of always, you know, really enjoyed that, to be honest with you. In terms of disarming people that are intimidating, I don't find very many people intimidating. That's not to say that people don't try to intimidate. I just don't find them intimidating. And the reason for that is, you know, I really try to look at people from a place of compassion. You know, I tell my kids, you know, if you ever encounter a bully or someone that's mean to you, I mean, it's not okay to be the way that they are, and you should never, you know, let it slide. Or if you see that it's happening to someone else, you should always step in. But I try to explain to them that it's never about you. When people come off and are, you know, really angry or have this, you know, anxious energy about them, like they're really trying to prove a point or they're trying to make you feel small, there's usually something about them. It's really never about you. And so I think that when I walk into these situations knowing that, it doesn't really irk me. I just do my thing. I just keep it factual. You know, I figure out what my leverage is and where it is and how to navigate the situation. And so there's really nothing to be done other than, you know, for me to continue working on myself, to know that, you know, it has nothing to do with me or the lack of what I bring, and everything to do with them. And if anything, I feel sorry for them.
Mm-hmm. I love that. I love it. So I get this question a lot, and I see the same thing in you, and I want to see your answer. So I get questions of like, well, how are you so confident? And like you also, I never took a victim mentality or gave it much energy being like a woman in a boardroom. Like I've been in largely male dominated fields. I've enjoyed being underestimated. I try and go as blonde and all that as I can, like throw them off, and I love it. And so I've had no issues, and I've never had problems really with confidence per se. You are a very confident woman, and it's backed up by knowledge and all these things. And it's not like you're over asserting yourself either. So I guess if you're trying to teach your girls to be confident, well-adjusted girls, and you mentioned the bullying, which I also agree with your comments there, what are some reasons or things that have helped you to become the confident woman you are that you would also impart on, you know, others, either other adults or young, you know, your kids?
You know, I think the biggest thing is just being comfortable with who you are, the good, the bad, and the ugly, right? Because when you're comfortable with who you are, you don't feel like you have to prove anything. Mm-hmm. And so it just naturally gives you this aura of confidence, because you know what you know, and you know what you don't know, and that's cool. And so when you don't really feel like you have to prove a point or impress anyone, None of your defense mechanisms kick in, so to speak. Does that make sense?
It totally does.
I mean, listen, do I have, you know, self-doubt sometimes? Of course. Do I sometimes look in the mirror and wish that, you know, my pants fit better? Of course. I mean, it happens to the best of us. But I think it's just like knowing that, accepting it, and just being cool with it is what I think leads to the most amount of confidence.
Yeah, I love that. I think also for me, it's been, I think it's just really putting in hard work. And obviously you do that as well. Like, I think when you put in the hard work, whatever it is, it can be anything. It can be work. It can be your fitness. It can be anything. When you really put in the time and the effort to improve whatever you're doing, you are able to accept where you are more easily because you're like, look, I know for a fact I have put in my best effort. I'm still a work in progress. Right, we always are at every level. But I feel like no one can take that from you. And it builds just a level of self-assurance where you're like, I know I have my, I know I can depend on myself.
Oh, yeah.
I follow through on what I say. I put in the hard work. I roll up my sleeves. And to me, like you're saying, like, no one can take that from you.
Right. No, I agree with you 100%. Yes, of course, it goes without saying that, you know, with the being good with yourself, you also have to respect yourself, right? And I think that to respect yourself, you have to put in the work. At least I do, right? I think that, you know, there's a different kind of confidence I think that people have. There's like the real sense of confidence when you know that like you're working your butt off and no one can take that away from you. And that's when I kind of said, like, you know what you know. Like, I would walk into this room full of men and I would just know it because I've done it a million times and I've put in the hard work, right? And then there's the false sense of confidence where you're just like, well, I have to be confident because I should be confident. So I'm just going to walk around like I'm confident. It's not grounded on anything, in anything. Mm-hmm. So it's not real confidence. Mm-hmm. I agree with you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really interesting. I love it. Okay, so I want to talk to you about running a business.
Okay.
So, and you mentioned that you actually really like your operations within your company, which is interesting. What are some leadership tips or efficiencies? What are things that you've done well running your team of 15 plus people that you think have really elevated your business or taken you to a different level or make you stand out, like your specific practice stand out because you know you do it the best? Are there any practical either leadership or just pure operational things that you know you have done that really work well that people can take away and apply to their own businesses?
Sure. Well, I think there's lots. I'm just trying to think which ones do I want to.
Okay, let's start with leading people. What's your leadership style?
I really like to empower people. I spend a lot of time with each one of my lawyers, my staff. We have actually a staff of 32. It's 15 lawyers when I said 15, it's just the lawyers. So we're not huge, but we're growing and we're bigger than I have ever had us be. I really like to spend time with every person and kind of gauge what their highest and best use is. And what's interesting is that I find that usually the highest and best use matches what this person enjoys doing the most. But sometimes they just don't know. They're confused. I mean, an easy example, I've had lawyers that were hired as litigators. And then after spending some time with them, they realized through my sort of helping them see it that they're actually better suited to do transactional law. And so we would switch them over and, you know, they would start doing this other thing. And I've actually had that done in admin too. Like there would be someone doing, I don't know, for example, phone intakes. And then we would ask them because we were shorthanded to help with some like financial projects. And they were just amazing. And I'm like, okay, this person shouldn't be here. They should be over there. So I think that, and listen, on a much higher scale, it's probably impossible to get to know every single person that deeply to really make sure that they are in the right place where they belong. And I thought about it, like how, you know, I want to grow the practice. What if we're 100 people? Like, what's it going to look like? And I think the solution is to hire someone that oversees specifically the HR operation that also has that skill, that ability to really get to know all the people and make sure that they are in the right place. So that's number one. Number two is just really like empowering them. Give, not micromanaging, giving them the responsibility and the freedom to the extent that possible to make their own decisions and to take ownership of their wins. And if there are fails, which undoubtedly there will be, you know, I read this somewhere, I think maybe it was Adam Grant who said this, but it really resonated with me. And I really, really try to remind myself this whenever I'm giving someone constructive criticism. You always have to be very clear that whatever you're criticizing this person on is a particular issue and not them as a person. Mm. So I really try to approach my employees with that. And I always say, look, this happened. I'm here not to scold you. I'm here so that we can talk about how we can fix it and make sure that it doesn't happen again. I mean, listen, if it's systematic, then that's a bigger issue. Right. But most of the time it's not, and we're human. And also humanizing myself, showing, you know, my own vulnerability so that they see that, okay, even though I'm their boss, you know, I'm not perfection. No one is perfection. All we can do is give it our best. And for them to just feel comfortable and for them to want to do good work.
I love that. I think that's so great. How about operationally as you're scaling? I think a lot of businesses, and especially today, I think because we're going from sort of like that paper old way of doing things to, you know, digital, analytical, data-driven, all of that. How have you leveled up your company to kind of keep up with just streamlining operations, being efficient, but also not dropping important, you know, the quality of what you do? Right. Any tips or perspective you have on that?
Yes. I think that documenting, well, having workflows is very, very important. My goal to one day is to have the firm, and, you know, everyone tells me that it's impossible to have a law firm that operates without an operator, but I don't agree with them. I think that if you put in place the proper infrastructure and the proper people, you could make it happen. So having really good, efficient workflows, making sure, because, you know, 90% of all the issues and screw-ups that happen because someone either didn't give proper direction or someone misunderstood the direction that was given to them, or they didn't have a proper reminder set, you know, telling them that they need to do something. So eliminating as much human error as possible by putting in workflows and documenting processes. So not only does that make work more efficient for everyone, it also protects you if someone suddenly leaves and you have to have someone else come in their place, right? Maybe this is a position where no one else can train them. But if you have it really well documented, then, you know, with a little bit of time and a little bit of effort, they can get the hang of it. So I think for me, that's the biggest key.
I love it. That's exactly how I was trained, and I'm obsessed. Yeah. I completely agree. I think also having that level of transparency around your business, whatever the operational process is, it's very easy to pinpoint mistakes.
Of course.
When it's transparent and you can, you know, remediate them as quickly as possible and make adjustments and all that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, even now, what happened the other day? Something went out of our office and it wasn't proofread, and, you know, we couldn't tell if it was the associate or the paralegal or the supervising attorney. It doesn't matter. It all got resolved, but, you know, I was like, okay, it's because we don't have a workflow around this. We need to create a workflow so everyone knows exactly what they're doing, because sometimes you get three people working on the same project and then person A thinks that person B is supposed to do something that person B thinks person A is doing, and then no one's doing it or doing it incorrectly.
That's right. Or I should say, and going to your comment about, you know, scaling up, is like what I noticed too when we had a team of, say, 30, 35, it's like, it's okay that for this one process, you know, for the first 10 years of the business and when the business is small, that there's three people here, they've been here for a number of years, and they all do it their way.
Right.
You can't scale on their way.
Right. And the other thing that I really love doing is, and I think it accomplishes so many different things, you know, if I'm trying to build the process around, I don't know, let's say like the paralegals, I'll call them into a conference room and I'll say to them, look, this is what I'm trying to do. I want your feedback. What's worked for you? What hasn't worked for you? How do you think this should look like? Because then I'm not in the trenches with them, so I don't know. So it gives me information, number one. Number two is it refines the process in a better way. They already become familiar with it more through us going through this exercise. And I get their buy-in because they feel like, and it's true, their opinion is valued. They're a part of creating this process, so they will be more inclined to honor it.
100%. That is exactly how I was able to make really big change in a short period of time in one of my companies, because of exactly what you just said, is like, when you try and push change on people, especially if they've been there for a long time, right, especially that, and it's very sensitive, you know, it's hard to adapt. But if you come at it from like, look, I'm not the expert in this process. Right. You are the expert. Exactly. I really want, like, what would make your job easier?
Right.
And all of a sudden, before you know it, the grumblings are dissipated, and right, they're really prideful about the changes that they right influenced. Right. So, exactly.
Well, that's how, listen, you know, it's only like 3 years ago, it was just me and a fax machine.
Wow.
3 years ago, 4 years ago. I'm trying to think. COVID happened, feels like a blur. 2020.
We all blocked it out from the trauma.
Yeah, 2018. Yeah, about 5 years. It's wow, just me and a fax machine.
Wow. You grew fast.
Yeah.
So how many other partners are there?
Two.
Okay. Grant.
And Dave Almarez.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, now I want to ask you about you personally.
Okay. What do you want to know?
What's your favorite date night dinner?
Oh, gosh. Favorite date night dinner. I'm trying to remember the last time we had a date night.
Aren't we all?
I don't know. You know what? I like trying new places.
Okay.
So I don't know. Like, if you ask me to pick like a go-to where we end up the most, I would say Asanebo in Studio City. It's a really yummy sushi spot.
Okay.
But I like trying new things.
Okay. How old are your girls? I know one turned 11.
One turned 10.
Oh, 10.
10.
Okay.
And the other one is about to turn 13. God help me.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes.
Is she going to have a bat mitzvah?
Well, so she turned 12 last year.
So she had it already.
We went to Israel.
Oh, wow.
So we were really lucky to be able to, like, it was last May. We just went right before, a few months before everything broke out. So we did that.
That's amazing. Yeah. That's incredible. I have a lot of anxiety over that chapter because I am the type that I actually hate throwing big events. Like, yeah. I didn't even want a wedding.
I didn't want to do it either. That's why we ended up.
That's so great.
Going to Israel and doing that.
I love that.
And it was amazing.
That's so great. Oh, I love that idea. Okay, I'm going to keep that in my back pocket. I try to convince my husband to not have a wedding.
You know, I tried to convince my parents to not have a wedding.
It didn't work. It didn't happen.
No.
You ended up with a big wedding.
Yeah, my husband was totally, he was like, let's just elope. It was the parents. Okay. Really, like, it was, you know, and then my mom, you know, Jewish guilt.
Yes,
well,
I know it.
When you have a daughter one day, and then I ended up with, I think we had like 400 plus people at the wedding, half of whom I didn't know. But my mom was happy.
I'm sure you looked gorgeous.
I did. It was a blur.
As it always is. Yeah, that's so great. Okay, so what do you do for yourself personally? Because I think it's really hard as, you know, an executive, a boss, you know, for lack of a better term, almost like a CEO in your situation, plus being a mom.
Right.
I'm sure it's so hard for you to find time for yourself. But what do you do for yourself? What works? What are you trying to achieve for yourself?
Sure. So I have actually been trying to be a lot more cognizant of taking time for myself.
Mm-hmm.
I just had this conversation with someone the other day who just came back from vacation, mm-hmm, and was telling me that, you know, he feels so rejuvenated. And I said, you know, I used to live from vacation to vacation. That's literally how I would live.
Mm-hmm.
I would just like go, 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 go. Mm-hmm. And I would know that I have a vacation coming up.
Yep.
And so I would just go until vacation, and then I would go on vacation. Everything was amazing. Then I'd come back and go again.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think some time ago, I realized that this is not, it's not very sustainable, because it's just the vacation is not enough to recover from the burnout. And then you fall right back into it when you come back. So honestly, I tried to find pockets of time, and I really tried to be mindful of sort of like how I feel, in the sense that if before I wouldn't realize that I've burnt out until I burnt out, and then I would be like, okay, I need some time. I now have a better radar, so to speak, where I'm like, okay, there's a lot going on. I feel myself getting overwhelmed, which is really not easy for me to get overwhelmed, but, you know, I just need to turn off my phone and leave the office at 3 o'clock and go on a hike. And so I do. In the past, I felt very guilty about doing stuff like that. But now I realize that it's actually for the benefit of everyone involved, because you can't pour from an empty cup. Mm-hmm. So I find pockets of time. I love yoga. I love going, there's Fryman Canyon is right around where I live. And when the weather is beautiful, I like to go on a hike. I love a good massage, facial, and also like spending time with my girlfriends and just having that social interaction and being able to bitch and complain to them about the stuff that's frustrating me, and just really like having a colorful social life, I think for me is also very energizing. Mm-hmm. And I really love it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love that. Yeah, I also realize like sometimes when, for example, I have a big deadline or like I'm feeling really pressured and for whatever reason, I'm just not connecting with the work. Like normally I'm very passionate about my work. And sometimes if I'm like burnt out or for whatever reason, I just need to just, I've been able to quickly recognize like, even if I sit down right now for 2 hours and force it, it's going to be a subpar product, which right. I don't want to deliver subpar anything
right.
ever.
Right.
So I actually make that shift much more quickly now. Mm-hmm. And I say, okay, this was supposed to be my time to get this done, but it's just not my time right now. And I will go and do something else and redirect. And then when I come back, by the time I'm ready, I'm ready. And right. I can knock it out and do a really good job.
Yeah. Well, I don't have a luxury like that very often because I'm interacting all day long, right? Usually I'm booked on the half hour, meetings, phone calls, you know, I do a lot of, you know, and so it's not like I can be like, okay, can't do this meeting right now. I mean,
George, get the hell out of my office.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
I can't deal with you right now.
I mean, look, there have been times very, very far and few in between where if it wasn't something mission critical, I'd just be like, fuck it all. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, I can't. Mm-hmm. And so I just kind of, we have a conversation, myself and I, and I'm like, all right, like just push through this one. Mm-hmm. And then you get to go do whatever. But also, mm-hmm. you know, I love what I do so much mm-hmm. that even when I'm feeling off, I get so into whatever it is that I'm talking to or whatever I'm working with that like, it's almost not me talking. Like it comes out of me, the
yeah.
flow.
Yeah, you're in your flow state. You know?
And that's it. And then I finish and I know that I have to go recharge my batteries, but I'm usually able to push through pretty well.
Do you work 7 days a week?
I work, yeah, I mean, 24/7, 7 days a week, but not. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I get it.
Yeah.
No, I get it. I think when you're, you know, again, a leader in a company, it's never, there's always.
Like I usually leave the office by 3.
That's good.
But I'm not off.
Right. I get
it. You know, and I think that's how I've been able to juggle the work and the kids. And again, I think it's a lot of it is about pockets. Mm-hmm. Like I'm always on, but if let's say, you know, I'm like, okay, I'm going to go spend one-on-one time with one of my daughters, put the phone away. I don't attend to it. I go do whatever I do with her. But then if I come back at 11 o'clock at night, I will pick up the phone. I'll go through the emails and I'll respond to whatever's mission critical.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And do you cook?
Yes.
You do? Do you love to cook?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Okay. What do you like to cook?
Gosh, everything and anything. You know, really? People say to me, like, how do you come home after a long day of work and cook? And I cook practically every night unless I'm like really dead. You know, it's like meditative for me. It's my creative expression, so mm-hmm. to speak. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, listen, during the week, I don't cook anything like oh so spectacular. It's mostly things that are nutritious and healthy and usually involve a protein, a vegetable, and a starch.
That's all you can ask
but
for.
But when I have the luxury of time, I love entertaining. I love hosting. I love cooking for, I'll tell you what my kid's favorite meal is
I make.
I make pasta in vodka sauce. Mm. And it's a recipe from Carbone mm-hmm. in Vegas. Mm-hmm. And they love it. It's their favorite ever. And then I also make a really good veal milanese. Mm. They love that too. Mm. Mm-hmm. Carbonara. You see like a lot of Italian stuff.
And do you have a glass of wine with your Italian food when you're cooking?
Yes, but I really try to like watch it.
Yeah.
I really try to watch it because like if I had it my way, I'd probably have it every night. And so I reserve it for like the weekends unless it's been a really rough day.
Got it. Okay, cool. What time does dinner start? Because I'd like to RSVP.
Just show up. I'll always find something to. The grilled cheese and tomato soup is always on the menu. That's like the go-to when like my husband opens the fridge and he's like, "Have we been robbed?" I'm like, "No, babe. It's Saturday because usually I'll grocery shop on Sundays because I'm very
systematic. That was gonna be my next question.
So I plan sort of in my head what I'm gonna make for the week, and then I go to the grocery store on Sunday. So often by Saturday, because we usually don't eat at home on Saturdays, there's like nothing. So he'll open the fridge and be like, "We get robbed."
Yes, I do know. I do know all about that, actually. Yeah, I was going to ask, does somebody go get the ingredients for you? Because I always find that once you have the ingredients and you know in your mind what you're going to make, like the doing it is more enjoyable. It's when you have all of the steps that you're like, oh my God, I have dinner and I don't have a meal plan and I don't have the ingredients. Like, it's just not it. That's not how you do it.
Well, so I do it like that sometimes. And my husband actually jokes that he's like, you like to play Chopped. You know that show on the Food Network they tell you, like, you have a can of corn and some salami and whatever, and like, go make a meal. So sometimes I'll do that. So much fun, though, because I get all, you know, ChatGPT is actually very useful. I literally will sometimes say, like, ChatGPT, I have give corn, me a recipe. Salami, you will always come up with something.
Awesome. That's so great. Oh my God.
So, you know, I grocery shop myself. We have a farmer's market every Sunday. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, most families are strolling there, like with their beautiful children, and they're dressed up. And I come in like my sweats with my cart. Like, I go there to work, you know? And I pick up all the stuff that I need, and I'll sometimes order groceries just because I find that to be easier. I like to order stuff from Italy a lot. Mm. It's far. Mm-hmm. So like, I don't always, from where I am, so I don't always have the luxury of driving out, but they'll deliver to me. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's a combination of, I don't have someone going. I don't do the cleaning, by the way, just so that you know. So if you come over for dinner, you got to wash the dishes.
No problem.
The rule in my house is like, I cook everything, but I don't do the dishes and I don't take out the trash. So I have a housekeeper that comes and she, you know, keeps the house intact and in order and does all that. But I do the shopping and the cooking myself.
You know, we live very similar, bizarrely, there you go. Oddly. Like, I don't do the trash and I don't do the dishes.
Fuck that.
No. Mm-mm. Yeah, I love it. I think that pretty much covers it. Did I miss anything?
No, I think this was so much fun.
You're so smart that I actually want to ask you so many things, but like, it would be so obnoxious.
You cannot just keep inviting me back for a podcast and I'll just give you free legal advice.
No, forget that. I don't even care about that. I want to go for drinks with you.
Okay, we could do that too.
Wait, will you be my best friend?
Yeah.
Yes.
Done. That's it.
Done. Okay, guys, we got to go. We're going to go party and drink. Just kidding. She's running back to her office.
That's right. Thank you so much for having me. This was so much fun. I could keep talking for hours with you.
And there is something that I'm going to share, not quite yet, but stay tuned, because Intella has some tricks up her sleeve coming up that we are very excited to share with you. She is a woman of many, many talents, and I assure you, you're going to want to hear what we have to say. So we will let you know about how to connect with her further. And I'm going to just leave it at that for now, because it's not time to announce what we're going to announce coming up. Okay, so stay tuned for that. And thank you guys for listening. If people do want to follow you, is there a place on either your website, like for your practice, or social media, anything that they can kind of investigate more about you at this time? Yes,
all of the above. So if they want to follow me on Instagram, I'm at Natella Shannon ESQ. Should I spell that? Since you had a hard time pronouncing my last name.
I will put it in the show notes.
Okay, perfect. So you can follow me on Instagram for that. I try to put out lots of nuggets of useful information on a variety of different topics. And then if you want to get in touch with me for legal talk, you can just go on our website. It's grantshannon.com. And you just call the main phone number and they will help you find me.
They will help you. They are so wonderful and welcoming. And really, you guys, if you need an incredible, incredible attorney, I swear this is your girl, that your woman. She's brilliant as she is warm and kind. So definitely excited for you to become aware of her and connect with her. So thank you guys very much for listening, and we'll chat with you next time. All right. That is it for today. Thank you very much for listening, and be sure to follow us at Iconic Nation Media and send us a direct message and comment on some of our posts so that we can hear your feedback and incorporate them into our show. We appreciate you listening, and we look forward to catching you next week.